Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi Nick, are you bored of drinking big fat shots of Director's Bitter and Ladyboy Chasers at home?
Tom, I ruddy bloody am. I'm hopping mad and just want some exciting craft beers to enjoy when I'm watching my Bond videos. That's not too much to ask, is it?
Well, have I got some good news for you. The fantastic chaps at Beer 52 have given us a special offer they'd like us to share with our listeners.
Can I just shock you? I like special offers. Do tell me more.
All you need to do is go to beer52.com/monkeytennis, cover the postage cost of £5.95, and you'll be sent a box of 8 cracking craft beers, plus a magazine, and 2 beer-appropriate snacks.
Wow, that is a real breath of fresh air. So you're telling me to get a free case of 8 unique craft beers from Beer 52, I just need to go to beer52.com/monkeytennis and cover the postage costs of £5.95?
Yep, it's literally that simple. It really is lovely stuff.
Oh, sometimes you want to say, sod all this wine, just give me 8 craft beers.
And I've really got to say this, Nick, Beer 52 is the world's largest beer club.
Mmm.
Yep, each month members are sent a case with a different theme. Past themes have included Belgium, Korea, California, New Zealand and many more.
But what if I don't like dark beers?
Ah, they've got that covered too. If you don't like dark beer, you can choose a light beer option. And you can pause or cancel at any time. Simply go to beer52.com/monkeytennis and just pay £5.95 postage to get all this now.
Crash, bang, wallop, what an offer. 8 free beers, a magazine and 2 snacks for less than £6 postage. Mine's not a pint, mine's a box of 8 craft beers. I'll drink to that. Welcome everyone to a new series of Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast. And it's a slightly different series this time as we celebrate 30 years of Alan Gordon Partridge. And we thought, what better way to celebrate than with a few fops on the podcast. So each week you're going to hear two of us from the podcast speaking to a special guest about their love of Alan, how they came to the show, their favourite characters and everything in between. We're going to kick off today's show with Josh Berry. You've probably seen his videos on social media across the last year, especially the Conservative Party advisor, Rafe Hubris. You will also no doubt be aware of his work on Dead Ringers and The Now Show. You can contact us. You can email us at thepartridgepod@gmail.com, facebook.com/thepartridgepod. Twitter, we are @thepartridgepod. Instagram, it's at monkeytennispod. Adam is manning the Monkey Tennis hotline 24/7. He is ready for your call, so please do call Adam. Please call Adam on 07923 600 017. Your calls really make his day. Or you can shout us all a coffee at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. And of course, don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Tom Dark and Tom Stab to hear their chat with Josh Berry about all things Alan Partridge. Enjoy.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle. Aha!
Absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little piece my foot on the spike.
With a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
Like, this is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net.
Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
It's the true host of the podcast, Tom Stab here, and I'm also joined by Tom Dark.
Hello.
And our very special guest. He's an impressionist, satirist, comedian, writer, and internet sensation, and he hasn't paid me to say that. He's been described by Steve Coogan's eater in crime, Rob Brydon, as a remarkable talent, and John Coleshaw as absolutely superb. It's Josh Berry. Hello, Josh. How are you?
Aha!
I mean, you might as well get in from the beginning.
Yeah, there we go.
The first thing I listed you as is as an impressionist, so... Yeah, well done. Very good. You've ticked that box.
That was good. It's not the hardest impression, you know.
Given those quotes that I just sort of read out are predominantly from famed impressionists, is that kind of how you see yourself? Mm. How would you describe yourself as a performer?
Yeah, I don't think I would anymore. I certainly did when I started, maybe a bit like Steve Coogan. In a much less talented Steve Coogan. I sort of started doing impressions and then I kind of moved on to doing sort of stand-up and then characters and more voices. So I wouldn't really consider myself as just as purely an impressionist just because I just have a bit more fun doing the character stuff. But I certainly do them. I do impressions. That's probably the distinction I draw, you know?
Well, we were going to ask actually because in your kind of credits list, you've obviously... done impression work on Radio 4, so yeah. Things like The Now Show and Dead Ringers, I believe. So when you've been on those shows, who have you impersonated? What voices would I have heard you doing?
Well, I did Jacob Rees-Mogg back in 2018, sort of, you know, sounding like that and saying Nano an awful lot. Who else did I do? I'm trying to remember. I think
I did Ian Stirling from Love Island, because that was sort of around that time, mate. Sort of like, you know, like summer.
I did Andy Murray as well, I think. But then on The Now Show, it's just kind of, it was, you know, Boris Johnson, I'm doing that, you know, for however long.
Before we get into the Partridge stuff, a little bit of sort of background and scene setting sort of thing. I guess the first thing to sort of touch on is the viral videos, certainly within the last year or so. Particularly with our friend from the Conservative Party, Rafe Hubris. Now, obviously, that has just kind of exploded in the last year or so. Was that something that you kind of had? There's only so much you can plan these sorts of things, and sometimes you know the success is down to circumstance and et cetera, you know, like a global pandemic. But how long had you been working on that character? How long had you been sort of developing these internet characters before they sort of really struck a chord?
I mean, to be honest, the first time I did Rafe was the first time I maybe thought about doing a character like that. And for people who haven't seen Rafe, Rafe Hubris is, the parody advisor to the Conservative Party, who's incredibly arrogant, complacent, and, you know, self-satisfied, full of Oxbridge confidence without maybe the intellect or certainly the, the hard work to justify that level of hubris, hence the name Hubris. I did a lot of stuff taking the piss out of posh people, of which I am certainly one. I can't deny that fact. And then I sort of saw a lot of stuff. I saw during the 2019 election, Michael Gove, he had Stormzy had said something about Boris Johnson, I think, and Michael Gove tweeted back at Stormzy his own lyrics. And I just remember thinking, what an unbelievably tone-deaf thing to do. Who on earth would advise him to do something so moronic? And I sort of, and I thought, oh, that would be funny, the idea of someone being like, oh, Govey, yeah. No, it'll really appeal to the man, Dem. Do that. That's a great move, mate. Yeah, see you in the number 10 toilets for a line, classic. You know, and it literally just came from there. But you know, I've spent so much time in my life meeting, you know, it's a bit like Partridge in this sense. There are hundreds of Rafe Hubrises in that if you ever walk down Clapham High Street or the King's Road, there's an unbelievable number of self-satisfied men in Ralph Lauren top saying, me, you know, I'm actually like fucking great. I realized it was sort of like a way to bleed in all of that stuff and all of, and you know, even if you didn't like politics, if you're one of those people or you know people like that, then I think it had some resonance. But no, to respond to your question, I didn't really plan it. I just sort of threw it out. And also, like, you know, a lot of it is, you know, quite very, well, not very left, but left-leaning liberal satire. And it sure came from me feeling frustrated and annoyed at what I perceive to be weak government decisions.
That's good for a bit of sort of scene setting. But, you know, yeah, let's start talking about what we're here to talk about. Let's talk about Alan.
So I think really, Josh, the place to start is actually, where did Alan start with you? When did you first become what we would say, perhaps, when did you first become Alan aware? Can you remember what series would have been your entry point? Perhaps what your first memory of witnessing Alan Partridge on screen may have been? Could you pinpoint any memories?
No, so a mate of mine sat me down and made me watch Scissored Isle for the first time. I can't remember. It would have been sort of, yeah, really around the time when I first started doing comedy, so maybe 2018. And oh my God, I think that's one of the best pieces of comedy I've ever seen. I just think it's so phenomenally tight. It's so cleverly done. It's so subtly, excellently performed. And it just flies by, the 45 minutes. You know, I'm sure you guys find this. You're watching comedy. It's even if you're enjoying it, you sort of, you're looking a bit at the clock and how long's it got to go, even if you like it, but not with that at all. It's like it was like a religious experience. It just took me out of, you know, the sense of time. And it's great.
See, I guess you must have had some awareness of Alan Partridge as a character before then. But was that the first time you actually sat down and watched an actual full program that he was in?
I think it probably was. I think I'd seen bits of Mid-Morning Matters, but it wasn't until then that I sort of, you know, it's a weird one, isn't it? Because sometimes you might be shown, because the thing about him is that he's so clever and brilliantly constructed that as a younger person, I probably wouldn't have fully appreciated the genius. And then I think I kind of got to that stage, sat down, properly watched it, and was like, oh my God, this is so clever. There's so much texture here, you know.
But was it kind of similar to, you know, when you discover a new band or something, but they're in their sort of fifth or sixth album, and you're like, I love this, and then you're like, oh, I've got this whole back catalog to delve into, and then you immediately go and start listening, or in this case watching, the early stuff and working your way up to the point that was your entry. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I'd say it was very similar to when I first watched Bo Burnham. It was a similar experience, and I just kind of went back through all of his work. But I was also very aware of the day-to-day around that time, and I've written a sort of satirically, satirical show built around impressions.
I was going to say, your fake news podcast, I thought, reminded me quite a lot of the day-to-day.
Right.
I feel like there's a bit of a lineage there.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very kind of inspired by that, ridiculing stuff, coming up with ridiculous stories. And I kind of in the third series, it became a bit more about using ridiculous stories as metaphors for the state of the UK, whereas obviously the day-to-day isn't really about that as much. But it's certainly, yes, the embryo was very much from the inspiration of that. But I used to love him in that, even though he's not a totally developed character in that. But I just remember watching that and just thinking, oh, that's so cool. Something that's so textured and developed came from, you know, just saying nonsense things over sport images.
that's really interesting, having those two things kind of anchoring like your entry point, because you've basically got
the Gibbons era, because I think Scissor Dial would have been 2016,
yeah,
and the Day to Day, which was what, 1992, three?
Yeah, people would have. I think it was 92. Yeah.
And I guess that they, you know, that there's such a wealth of kind of character development between those two. So that must have been quite a kind of interesting thing, because I think for someone like myself or Tom, like, you know, we've grown up with Alan being a character kind of in the background of British comedy since the '90s. It's kind of, he's never fully gone away. So that is really interesting.
The other thing I find quite interesting here is that Josh is, you're saying that your sort of your entry point for Alan was Scissor Dial, and you hold that in such reverence and high regard. And it's been quite interesting from doing the podcast that there seems to be generations of Alan fans whose favourite Alan or the one that they like the most tends to be their entry point. So, you know, we've covered Knowing Me, Knowing You, the radio show. And for a lot of people on our Twitter and our socials, they're like, that's my favourite Alan. That's my entry point. That was when I was a student or whatever. And it was, and for Tom, who's a 2 or 3 years older than me, his entry point, the one that he holds in high regard, is I'm Alan Partridge Series 1, I'm Alan Partridge Series 2, and then you have someone like yourself who's a bit younger than us, the entry point and the reverence you hold is Scissor Dial. So there's very much generations and eras of Alan that people just seem to really hold their entry point as the thing that they go back to the most, or the thing that they like the most.
Nostalgia.
Nostalgia thing. Like, you know, in 10 years' time, you'll look back on this time, etc., and go, no, it was still Scissor Dial is the one for me.
Like Doctor Who, I guess. That's what everyone says, right? Yeah. It's like whoever your Doctor. Like for me, probably always Christopher Eccleston, because that was the one I was saying. But I'm not one of those adults who likes Doctor Who, though. I'm not a loser. I just remember I've been to the Fringe in the summer of that year, and I saw a guy called Tom Neenan, who's an excellent writer and does lots of stuff at the MASH Report and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a show called It's Always Infinity, and he played this amazing sort of parody of a virtue signaling feminist that was sort of himself, and it was about his journey to find his girlfriend. It was all very pretentious and deliberately so, and really excellently written. And I remember watching that and just thinking, oh, I love that. I love the idea that you can make a joke that's funny because it's from someone's perspective that we all recognize is a bit kind of exaggerated. And having watched Partridge after that, that just sort of felt like such a wonderful extension of that premise. And I found that so exciting, just the idea that, you know, there's that bit in Scissor Dial where he's talking about David Cameron giving big breaks to big businesses or tax cuts to big businesses. And I'm just like, that's so funny that, yes, Partridge would think that's a wonderful thing, but clearly Coogan is like, this is a terrible thing. And it was actually kind of that sort of idea that definitely helped form the idea of Rafe, the idea of like ironically praising something that you think is not good. I just sort of found it so exciting. I just thought it was so rich and interesting.
I think we've talked about that quite a lot on the podcast, that essentially we often call it something like Alan yes, Coogan no. It's exactly that thing where you know that they're kind of in diametric opposition. And in fact, that's, I think, the phrase that Steve Coogan has been using a lot in press recently, that he kind of now has the opportunity to get viewpoints through using Alan as like a Trojan horse type thing. So I think you've got this... I think they used to be kind of, as characters, in direct opposition to each other. And I think perhaps now you're getting to a point where Steve Coogan's viewpoints about certain things in society, which might be a bit too scandalous, maybe too grand a term, but might be a bit too scandalous to say, he can say them through the character of Alan. So I think you've got a really interesting kind of blurring of what those distinctions are the longer the character exists for, probably.
Absolutely. Hasn't he said in an interview though, is that, well, I am Partridge, he is me, right? Like, I've someone,
he does kind of say that now, they're kind of blurring into one. Yeah.
But that's the thing. I think as someone who does characters, I can definitely say like that they're often like big chunks of borrowed from certainly elements of yourself. I can really see that's true. Is that the interesting thing, I guess, is guessing what the person actually thinks, like what are the bits that Coogan actually believes? Because I imagine Coogan does have like a cleaner, right? So like all the stuff in the Oast House, which just amazing.
Yeah.
About the cleaner. That's almost certainly from Coogan's like interaction with a cleaner and thinking, oh, this would be funny, wouldn't it? Or, you know, what would be good here?
And kind of like ramping things up to an extreme.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's what it all is. It's just like taking small aspects of your life and being like, well, would this be funny if this was sort of changed in, subtly or ramped up here or whatever? And then you end up with a really authentic character, which is obviously what Partridge is. I mean, that's the wonderful thing. I think he is just like all men of a certain age, right? There's so
many things that you see in like your dad and stuff like that in Alan's. Like, that's exactly what my dad or what my uncle would say. Yeah, men of a certain generation. I think one of the points you made on the podcast recently was that when he does his accidental Jimmy Savile impressions, we said that that's sort of like muscle memory for a generation of men who like they slip into a Jimmy Savile impersonation because that's what they would have been doing for the last 20 years. They've just got it from muscle memory. So it's just kind of they don't change. They just stay that in that like pocket of when they sort of develop into men, whatever were their influences, whatever were their kind of, you know, who they hung out with and stuff like that, they just maintain all the way through, and they, you know, a certain generation of men will still do Jimmy Savile impressions.
Oh man, I had a bit where I used to do that on stage.
And just, is it cut now?
Yeah, well, yeah. Before he got bloody cancelled, he was always creepy, wasn't he? But that particular bit in what's that in episode 4? Of this series,
yeah,
just gone.
Certainly the second series of this time, yeah.
Well, I think there's a Savile moment in the first series and the second series.
Finally. Yeah, there is when he does
that's in it's Mid Morning Matters, isn't it? It's a Mid Morning Matters moment.
Oh, that's great. So he does that a lot in The Trip, doesn't he, as well?
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's the best gig in the world, isn't it, for Coogan and Brydon? Go to all these amazing places, eat this amazing food, and just do impressions for a couple of weeks. Sounds great.
Yeah, yeah, but they do it very well. I think it requires the sort of comic foundations that they have to do it, because some people you put in that instance and it wouldn't be as funny, right? Like that, and the way they improvise, and when Brydon's doing all the voiceovers, it's just like amazing when he's doing the you know, he's like, when you're saying something like, see in store for details, yeah, and it sort of goes through all the different types of, like, you know, terms and conditions may apply, I love it. I love the way that they can just flip into it just straight away. It's amazing.
So if you've got any sort of personal Alan anecdotes or real Partridge life, you know, real life moments, accidental Partridges, things like that. Have you ever drunk a ladyboy chaser?
Certainly haven't done that yet.
We did it on the podcast. I would not recommend it at all.
Really? What is it again? I forget the exact ingredients.
So it's a pint of lager, gin and tonic, and a small Baileys. Is that right? Amazing. I think that's right.
Yeah. And
but I think really this is kind of what we're talking about is the kind of the era at which you discover it, and then the kind of influence that Alan as a character can have in terms of, you know, discovering Alan in the midnight. So basically, having Alan as a character to quote and reference throughout kind of school years into university years, I think then does have these kind of like wider real life repercussions where you're drinking ladyboys in the pub, or you're doing a sports casual themed party, or like Nick, one of the other hosts on this show, he went on a Partridge themed stag do in Norwich and things amazing like that. And I think the question is kind of, has anything from the world of Alan crossed over into real life for you, anything like that, or is it just kind of, do you find that you have maybe groups of friends where you'll always end up quoting Partridge lines to each other or anything like that? Do you find it bleeds into life like that at all, or is that just us?
No, I definitely quote it. I quote and analyze it a lot with friends who are comedians, and my girlfriend really likes it. I often will like force her to sit down and be like, oh, come watch this, you'll love it, it's amazing, and she'll be like, you know, it just won't be interested, but Partridge she loves. And I often quote, I love it when the quotes that I love the most And actually, probably the element of Partridge that I love the most, and I think it's a really essential comic component of great British comedy characters, is that Alan Partridge is doing an impression of something that he isn't, right? Which is like a sort of much more, particularly when he's sort of with sort of the era of Me Too and stuff, and how uncomfortable he is with the makeup girl in this particular series. There's a sort of sense that he like the constant correction, but you get the sense that there's an overcorrection. And I think that's what I find so amusing. And it's very David Brent as well, right? Like David Brent's trying to come across as more, I don't know, left wing than he is, or more PC or professional than he is. And Partridge is certainly trying to, I think, do the same thing. He's trying to come across as more PC and neutral than he actually is. But the hilarious thing is where you know exactly what his perspective on the issues is. Like that, there's that bit where he's like, you know, you'd see a woman asking difficult questions, and a lot of people would say she's nagging, and I say let them. And you just think that is such a wonderful reveal of his perspective on the world, right? So a lot of it's that. I love the hygiene bit in that. You know, when he's doing the hygiene. So, yeah, hygiene. Hi, Gene. Amazing. The same similar joke with Roger, wasn't there, in the last episode of Series 2. Roger, that.
There is something in that, because it's perhaps less imitable if it's Alan hosting a TV show, whereas if it's kind of more bizarre scenarios where quite memorable dialogue comes out of it. So I think that's the thing. I think particularly with I'm Alan Partridge series 1 and 2, there are just so many classic quotable lines. And I think perhaps the way something like This Time or Mid-Morning Matters works, there's a whole kind of layer of subtlety and nuance, which maybe wasn't there in the mid-90s, because that's had to grow as the characters developed. So that suddenly means it's less about him saying Jurassic Park. It's more about him saying, let them have a natter, that sort of thing, where it doesn't necessarily work as a quote out of context, but in the context of what the other characters in a scene are saying, that's where it's funnier. So it is less about, ooh, ladyboys and shouting Dan and things like that.
But I think that's what I love about it. It's just that subtlety, the sort of three or four layers of texture to it that make it so entertaining. And although there was one of the things that really cracked me up, but again, this isn't really a quote, I suppose, it's not something I quote, but it's the bit with Cheeky Monkey in this series just gone. And he's talking about you know, where women who are suffering from domestic violence can seek refuge. And I just find it so funny that it's all really credible, like sensible advice about it, which, because you're just totally not expecting that to come out.
Yeah.
I just thought that was so well constructed. And the bit at the end where Susanna Fielding's like, I really hope we didn't trivialize any of the issues, which I just thought that was amazing. But yeah, no, I don't really know if it's, It's all the little things with him, isn't it? It's like in the chemsex bit, where there's chemsex, you know, graffitied on the pavement, and then underneath the Alan Partridge signature. You know, it's that unbelievable strokes of subtlety that I certainly feel like I've learned masses from, and it's just so enjoyable to watch for sure.
Do you think so? And so we talked a bit about, so you have your own podcast, Josh Berry's Fake News. There's definitely a touch of the feel of the day to day about that. But do you think either Steve Coogan or Alan Partridge as a character have influenced anything more in your comedy in any way? Or, you know, is it as simple as being inspired by a very proficient and talented impressionist? Or do you think there's anything in a more detailed level that you might have taken away from either being a fan of Partridge or a fan of Coogan over the years?
Well, I think, you know, I think what Coogan does with impression, well, what, you know, in starting with impressions, I think that gives you quite a good grounding to go on to do characters, because, you know, impressions are all about picking out little details, creating caricatures of people. And then from there, you have the sort of analytical skills of observation to go on and do that. So I guess in that sense, it's been helpful. But yeah, I mean, also in terms of watching Alan Partridge and just the ridiculousness, the silliness of it all, and the ridiculing of his perspective certainly has been helpful for developing Rafe as a character. But, you know, I'd sort of consider Rafe is sort of, he's a generation on, so things are quite different in many respects. And I also think sort of the way that Partridge presents, it's interesting because it doesn't really present in the same way a generation on. I think we're probably all, arguably, in my opinion, quite rightly, a bit more woke now than he and people of that generation is. And so like overcorrection still exists, but it exists in a sort of a slightly different way. But yeah, I think, you know, just the language of it and the idea that you can make jokes from the perspective of someone who's fundamentally a bit of an idiot or a bit of a plonker, that was incredibly helpful. And so yeah, I mean, he's the best reference point character wise, I think, for doing something like Rafe. I mean, because I can't think of anyone in the UK who's there to touch Alan Partridge. You know, I don't think he's above and away the best comedy character, surely.
I mean, you're definitely in the right place to get an agreement.
Well, yeah, sorry, yeah. I mean, obviously you're going to agree with that on the Alan Partridge podcast. But, you know, yeah, I mean, surely. I mean, I can't think of... But you know, who's... I mean, who else does comedy characters in the UK? I mean, like, well, Sacha Baron Cohen, but then his are sort of, like, slightly different, and arguably they're not as textured. David Brent is surely sort of in the similar ballpark, but...
But I mean, yeah. You know, there is no other real character that has endured for you know, nearly three decades in so many different, I mean, in so many different forms. I mean, one of the points we make on the podcast is that in some respects, Steve Coogan / all the writers who have worked on it have been quite lucky in the sense that Alan is a presenter at heart. That's what he does. So naturally, his job can be kind of retrofitted into lots of different things: podcasting, yes, hosting a TV show, doing a radio show, you know, a chat show, etc. So, you know, in that regard, they've kind of been a little bit lucky. But that does not take away from the fact that, you know, even with that, you still have to nail the writing, nail the character development, nail so many things surrounding it. And I'm struggling. I don't think I can put, I mean, you there may be something that you can think of, but I can't really think of anything where they've missed. Like, not everything has been 10 on 10. Not everything has been, you know, world class, but there have been no misses as far as I'm concerned.
But that's consistently what I say to my mates, you know, people who do stand up as well and write and stuff. And they all say, like, that's the best thing about it. It's like, even if you don't love an episode as much as another one, they're all great, right? They're all really good. And he's so good at sort of, I just think that it's worked so well. It's worked within like an inch of its life, the comedy. And I don't mean that, it's certainly not overworked, but it's just like so excellently crafted that it you don't see the jokes coming. It's so creative. There's so much amusing failure. There's so much fast. Partridge has become really, like, the physicality is excellent, you know. In this series, like, the joke with the cocktail was so excellent, and the timing of that was just brilliant. Or him talking about jumping up onto a stage, or in the previous series when he's talking about washing your hands without, or so using a toilet without washing your hands. You know, it's amazing. There's so many components to it that such a work rate that goes into the show and the writing of it, clearly, that I can't think of anyone that's really comparable.
So what are your sort of, you know, favourite moments, scenes, series? Are there any sort of minor characters outside of, you know, the big ones that everyone kind of knows and loves that that you kind of have a fondness for?
I think in terms of moments, I mean, the checkout bit in Scissored Isle is just always stuck with me. I just think that's so whole 3 minutes, right, that... I even learned, you know, that he's like, this is a supermarket, but it's not just a place to buy cheese, chops, chucks, and cheap chicken, chicory, and chives. I loved it so much and then the bit at the start where he's like, it just shows exactly the class that he comes from, because he meets the guy that is like the manager of the store, and he's like, and you own the shop, do you? And, you know, it's just so great. And, but the, yeah, that whole bit is just amazing. I love the idea of him. Well, firstly, it's really an amusing impression of a checkout lady that he does. You know, that is just funny. But then you've got the wonderful thing of Partridge thinks it's a good idea to do that. So you've got like this idea of like, it's an upper middle class person doing an impression of the working class to appeal to an audience. And there's something that's so wonderful about that, I think, and so subtle. And that's definitely something that I've really like, found very helpful, like in creating like my Bristol Raver character, which is supposed to be that. It's supposed to be a posh, you know, ex public school person pretending to be, you know, like a grime artist or whatever, which is just riddled with problems and embarrassment. And so yeah, I mean that's amazing. And then the end bit where he's clearly just thought to himself, oh shit, we better do something about how important all these people are. And he like improvises that bit about the trolleyman, right? And then
Yeah.
And he's like, for what is a trolleyman? And he does that whole bit about that. And I just, and it's that as well that I just thought was so brilliant, because it's like, that's so obvious. It's so obvious that he's gone, oh shit, I haven't got everything I need. And then he, you know, just does that. But none of that's said, none of that's acknowledged. But and yet it is so clear. I just thought that was just brilliant, brilliant writing.
I guess there's always a good layer of the joke with Alan, particularly Gibbon's era Alan, where you have to do a bit of the legwork yourself in terms of the background of what the production process is like, what the Pear Tree Productions or Pear Tree Factual Productions process is. So that's never on camera. It's never explicitly referred to. But if you're a hardcore fan, you know there's a layer of jokes in terms of some of the edits might be bad, some of the voiceovers might be OTT, all that sort of stuff, 100%, yeah.
And that's so clever, right? Because that's just like, you're right, there's that wonderful thing of having to fill it in. And that's a really nice motif in stand-up, you know, when a stand-up will do the first half of the joke and then the audience laughs because they filled it in. And yeah. I love that. It makes it more collaborative, I always feel like. I will talk about the characters I like, but the one other thing that I haven't said that I just love, and I'm sure you guys will agree, is how much more camp Partridge has become, I feel like, certainly in the sort of later series. I'm nearly certain that's entirely Richard Madeley. I mean, it must be that sort of very, you know, the very sort of catty, him doing an impression of a sort of catty, chatty lady. And that bit where he's at the silent retreat, and he's like, so do you not speak? And he's like, well, I wouldn't be much of a spokesperson if I didn't speak. And he's like, oh, Cassie, all right. And I love that. I love that sort of, it's so funny. The sort of the real, yeah, I can't really put my finger on why it is, but it's just so entertaining.
I think you're right. I think there's definitely, again, it's all about that development because it's that kind of 30-year gestation period to where we are now. It's, I think, you know, when he started in the 90s, it was very much supposed to be a John Motson type character.
Yes, right.
And
right,
just
right.
More of a sports reader trying to... I think perhaps the reason why he still works as a character so well is because he's always trying to... The character is always trying to be what he thinks he needs to be. Yes. So if it's trying to be, if you think back to something like in Knowing Me, Knowing You, when he's trying to grow a moustache because he thinks he needs to be a bloke and things that I'm Alan Partridge, like, oh, you know, waking up, he's been drinking all night and he's actually been asleep for 45, but all that sort of stuff, like trying to be what he thinks is kind of like a man in the 90s.
Yes, yes.
And whereas
now
in like 2021, trying to be what he considers slightly more left, slightly more woke. There's always that inherent struggle about who he is, which is basically not necessarily a nasty person, but a bit of an idiot trying to be somebody to appease broadcasters and other people around him. And I think that's kind of the beauty of it, that's always an evolution. That's always in flux.
Yes. And that's where the comedy comes from. It comes from that gap. And you've much more eloquently put what I very humming and ahringly, Hugh Grantingly, tried to say earlier on. You know, he's very interesting and I love him. But, you know, that it's exactly that. It's the gap between what they what they're trying to be and what they actually are, which is the same with Brent. And, yeah, I just think that's so entertaining because he's always right on the verge of failure as well. And there's, I think that's another essential component. There's enough, you know, comedy and failure should go hand in hand, particularly in Britain, I think. I think in America, I'm not sure it's quite the same. They tend to prefer like high status stuff. But Stephen Fry says something excellent about this. He's like, the British comic hero would want a bus to run into a puddle and soak them, whereas the American comic hero would want to be driving the bus. That's basically the sort of fundamental distinction between, which I thought was a really, you know, way of putting it. And Partridge has that excellent degree of failure, you know, all the time, which I think is so important.
It'd be interesting to get your take on, as someone who is, like I say, slightly younger than us and whose entry point was Scissored Isle, having gone back and watched earlier Partridge, what you think and what your thoughts are on current Partridge versus current Partridge versus past Partridge, and what you think the sort of Gibbons brothers, how their writing is different compared to the 90s Alan, and how do you think he's developed, and what are the good things and what are the maybe not so good things that you don't like as much?
I just love the how much, like we've sort of been saying, how much comedy comes from botched bits and stuff that isn't said and awkward performance. And, you know, particularly in the Oast House, actually, he does this thing where sometimes I get to the end of a sentence and go a bit like that. And, you know, he's like sort of developed the voice so that the voice has more comedy. And I certainly prefer the more modern stuff, I have to say. Just because I think I just see more, so much more development in the character, and it's not that the previous stuff isn't good, and the format's really funny, and you know, it's a wonderful like failure, you know. So often on Knowing Me, Knowing You, it's just an excellent show goes wrong type format. But I feel like with this, there's just so much more to chew on, and that's what interests and excites me. I feel like I'm at a place with Rafe at the moment where it's like he's still quite new and early, and I feel like there's a lot more interesting stuff that I could do, but that takes a lot of time. And so I kind of feel like real like a desire to emulate later Partridge for that reason, because it is such a subtle and complicated character.
So you're saying you've got a 30-year arc planned for Rafe?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he could. I think he'd be pretty good on Good Morning. What's the new Piers Morgan thing?
Oh, GB News.
GB News, or maybe a slot on LBC. He'd be quite good doing that. I think that'd be quite funny.
Imagine if in 30 years you're doing Rafe and he's PM.
Well, that's the thing. I think he's got to ascend gradually up the Conservative Party. I think important.
But failing upwards.
Absolutely. And as most politicians tend to. I think there's a. I would say the later stuff, because I'm particularly from the Oast House as well. I mean, that I just thought that was just unerringly excellent. I mean, that was, you know, this time is great, and I'm a huge fan, but just from the Oast House, I just thought it was so, so good. There's so many payoffs. The gag rate is like every 20 seconds almost, I remember thinking. So I would say, I mean, I do prefer the later stuff, but you know, it's all great. But yeah, it's fascinating that he just came from, you're right, John Motson or Coogan just coming up with a voice, you know, being, oh, can you do a sort of a sports commentator? And then being like, oh, well, they all sort of sound a bit like that. And then suddenly that was born.
Yeah, I think that's the infamous story, isn't it? That I think he did that voice and then somebody in the room said, that guy's definitely called Alan Partridge. And I think Richard Herring claims that he's the one that said that.
But yes, he did.
Whether that's true, I think we'll never know for sure. But yeah, I think it was as simple as that. It's like the voice gave birth to the name, which gave birth to a fuller character, in essence.
To be to be in that writing room when they were coming up with all these character traits for this guy that they're just kind of imagining and sort of like building a world around him sort of in a room over, I don't know, however, what period of time, must have been incredible to be in that room with those comedic minds. Yeah. I always feel like, you know, it must be amazing to be in the room when certain bands write certain albums. I'm like way more excited about like what it was like in that writing room for the early days of Partridge.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, this is why the stuff I was saying about, you know, doing the impressions, because he has that vocal, like, you know, that real sort of prodigious vocal talent. Well, he's old now, so he can't be a prodigy anymore, but, you know, virtuoso comic talent, impression talent. You know, that allows, Stuart Lee said this, he was like, it just allows you to create an entire backstory just from the voice. You hear the voice, and you're like, oh God, yeah, I know exactly how this person's breath smells. I know what they do on the weekends, you know, I know what they like to eat or whatever. And I think that's been my entry point for creating characters. It's, oh, okay, this voice, I recognize this voice from something, and then you build it from there. And I feel like that's how Partridge was created. I think it's a really good way to do it.
I think there's definitely a lot of credence for that, because I think they've talked about, you know, he has to have the right socks on when he's being Alan. You know, it's down to that level of detail to kind of inhabit the character. And I think because it is such a well-rounded character where, you know, he styles his hair like this, he wears those sort of socks, he wears these sorts of suits or jumpers or whatever. Yeah, that's all built in, definitely.
Yeah, there's actually a clip from behind the scenes of Mid-Morning Matters, I don't know which series, where Steve Coogan puts his feet up on the desk and he says, actually, can we get wardrobe in here? I need to change these socks. Alan wouldn't wear these socks. So it's that level, that painstaking level. Like, no one is going to see them. Like, his feet aren't up on the desk in the scene.
I know, but...
but he has to have those socks on because of the attention to detail.
But the best comedy, you know, is that. It's that unbelievable, you know, like him putting his signature by Chemsex, or him driving a Vauxhall, or you know, whatever. It's even down to his belt in the last episode, the whole outfit is just, you know, it's perfect. And that for me is the comedy that I just have so much respect for. I mean, sorry if this is blasphemous, but in Bo Burnham's recent special, he has a whole bit where he's doing a song, and there's a bit where he shows a whiteboard that has about maybe 15 jokes on it, and the whiteboard is on the screen for 2 seconds.
Yeah.
I went back and paused it and read the whole thing.
No, me too. Yeah, it's just amazing. Absolutely. And for me, Partridge has the similar level of work rate. And I just have so much respect for that, because Coogan clearly cares enormously. And that's certainly what's said about him. He cares enormously about the end product. And, you know, the end product is obviously testament to that. He's amazing. I have a story about him, actually. I haven't told you about this. It's not very exciting, but I was once in. So just lower your expectations.
Well, we are excited now, so let's see. Let's see how it goes.
About that.
Go for it.
I once opened a toilet door for Steve Coogan at the Edinburgh Fringe. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't say thank you, which is fine. Although I did have to really fight the urge. I had to really fight the urge not to go, you go careful, Alan, I'll free help parking. But I didn't do that. But I really wanted to be like, that's 44.80, love. Take your time.
I do wonder for him, like, he's mentioned in interviews in the past that, you know, he likes it when the man in the street comes up and says, I think what you're doing is great.
Yeah.
But then there's a line between someone saying that, I really like your comedy, I think you're great, and someone shouting Dan at them. And it's kind of, you know, that's there are two sides of it where, you know, when you get to that level of fame and that level of sort of cut through in terms of society and comedy within, you know, certain generations, that must be, again, it's kind of, you know, I take it back to the band analogy, when you're at a gig and, you know, people want to go for the hits, that's not interesting for the person on stage. Yes. They want to play the new stuff that they've been working on. And I think the lucky thing, obviously, well, not lucky thing, but the good thing for Steve and Partridge is that new material, that those new songs are as good, if not better, sometimes than the old stuff.
Yeah,
It would be, you know, again, we've made this point on the podcast, it would have been so easy for them to just phone this in and just do quotes, just do them sort of rehashing the Jurassic Parks and things like that, and it's they're cleverer than that, they're better than that, and it's the proof is in what we see on screen. So it's interesting to hear sort of someone slightly younger than us say about how it influences them and what they see in the character are the same things that we kind of pick up on as well.
Yeah, but it's just the work rate. It's like there's no don't bother doing something if you don't give everything to it. It's all right if it fails, but like just be ambitious, you know. And I think he definitely is, and that's a brilliant thing. That was funny though, shouting down at someone. I can understand why that annoys him. Although when people shout Rafe's catchphrase at me, I really enjoy it. And they say, "Oh, how are we?"
Do you get?
How are we? Yeah, very well. But I love it. I love that. Whereas actually, I really don't like it when they ask me about me, because I've had that as well, and they'll be like, "Oh, so wow, you the guy?" And I'm like, oh, I don't know. Yeah, I guess. And then they'll be like, "Oh, how'd you come up with it?" And I just, and then I don't really know what to say, so I just try and say something funny, like, "Oh, well, you know, when you had as sad a childhood as I did, you'll find anything, you'll do anything for people's affirmation." And then I've said that to people, and they just sort of look at me blankly as if I've dribbled on their shoe or something. So I to be honest, I much prefer there's a degree of anonymity when you do it in character, but I can also understand why Coogan would get pissed off.
He owns it now. He's got past the difficult stage of people, you know, shouting catchphrases at him. And now he's kind of come full circle and gone, you know what, this is a great thing. Whereas maybe 15, 20 years ago, 10 or so years into the creation of Alan, it might have really pissed him off. But I think he's a bit more mellow, much like sort of Alan has sort of grown and developed. So has Steve.
Do you think so? That's interesting. Do you think his like political beliefs and stuff have sort of mellowed and chilled out, because he did all that stuff.
Are we talking about Alan or Steve?
Well, I don't know. I mean, certainly Steve. I think Alan, yeah, I don't really know. I don't know if Alan's have chilled out, but I wonder if Steve, because, you know, he obviously had all the hacked off stuff, and then, yeah, I don't really know. But then in the trip, he always seems quite, sort of fervent in his beliefs and very kind of set in what he thinks. It's difficult to know. I don't know.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So back to this time. How you know, on the podcast we've been very, you know, sort of positive about both series. How have they compared to you? Just taking those in isolation, how your opinions on series one versus series two?
You know, I think they're both great. Actually, I think I was, I don't know whether, yeah, no, I was a bit worried. I was like, oh, is series two going to be as good as series one? Because I thought series one was so awesome. Mm. But no, I mean, I think he's just, I just thought it was so consistently excellent. The bit with the poem as well in episode three.
The BBC.
Yeah, oh, that was just, it was just phenomenal. No, I mean, I think they're both of a really high quality, and I think they were absolutely right to bring back the premise for another series, because there's a lot to mock in that sort of one show format. And it's really nice to see, you know, it's just so cool to see, like, the BBC establishment get mocked on an establishment channel at a really mainstream time, right? It's amazing. And we need that,
I
think.
I mean, I've said that a lot when we've been covering this current series. I think it's incredibly bold of the BBC to, in essence, allow themselves to be mocked on BBC One like that. I think that's kind of, it's a bold decision by them, but I think that's really allowed the writing to be as strong as it can be, because they've clearly not had to be excessively censored by the BBC allowing them to do the show, which I think is great.
And also, like, you know, we're the problem is we talk a lot about satirical shows and satirical shows being cancelled, and obviously the Mash Report was cancelled, but like, that is, this is a satirical show on a prime time, you know, channel, and I think, like, that, you know, we should value it for what it is, which is a real piss take of the establishment, and I think that's such an excellent thing, and I think that's what comedy is all about. You know, well, obviously it's not what it's all about, but a very big chunk of it should be about taking the piss out of the received narrative that we get from shows like The One Show or The News or whatever.
And I guess maybe the targets for Partridge have changed over the years, because I think it was perhaps more about mocking NAF presenters in the 90s, and now it's more about mocking the mechanisms around it, in a way. The actual show, the show itself is the subject of the mockery, instead of, well, I guess the people are also part of that, so it's wider.
Yeah, that's why I love the later stuff, because I feel like that, yeah, there are sort of three or four things that he's drawing our attention to, which is so great. And also, you know, as anyone who's sort of done work for the BBC or at the BBC, it's particularly enjoyable, because you sort of, you get a sense that, you know, that it is a bit like that in many ways. That's why W1A is so funny.
I mean, that's basically a real-life documentary. Having spent some time not working for the BBC, but just doing meetings at various BBC buildings, I can even attest to how true to life some of those things are.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just a wonderful... But, you know, more excellent work from the BBC for putting that on. You know, people love slagging it off, but... I've seen Coogan in an interview said that, you know, I think he's right. It is a wonderful thing, like the NHS. Like, it's two things that we should feel very proud of to be British. And, you know, I think it can be very easy to feel, to struggle for things to feel proud to be British for. But I think those two things really, we really ought to feel proud of and really ought to value. And I think he does. And you get that sense in the show that he loves the BBC. And I think that's a nice thing.
Well, that's what we said about that poem. We actually said that was a Coogan yes, Alan yes. That's like their views have diverged at that point, and it's at that point they're kind of unified. So I was going to jump in with some controversial questions here. Are there any parts of the APU that you haven't seen? Any eras, any Alan output that you haven't watched or read or heard? Have you got any gaps in your APU knowledge?
I'm sort of aware of all of it, but I haven't necessarily sat down and watched all of it, or I haven't read Alan when he's talk about Partridge. But it is certainly on my list. I would very much enjoy that. I think it's, how long is that? I think it's quite long, isn't it?
Well, I can tell you the audiobook is 6 hours long.
Okay, well that's probably not that long.
I would, as someone who has done both, and I think Tom will back me up on this. Do the audiobook rather than read it.
100%. Yes, yeah. So the Oast House. Maybe he learned that lesson and doing the Oast House, because he could have just written the Oast House, right? But it just makes more sense.
Yeah, but then
sense.
Amazon paid them a load of money. So that's what happened.
Yeah, I'm sure there was some...
As opposed to a publisher.
Yes, right. I suppose you double up, don't you?
I think we could definitely recommend... So iPartridge, I think, is collectively probably one of our favourite pieces of the APU. I think that's definitely...
Yes, great.
That's definitely top tier. 100%. The next controversial question is, has there been an iteration or an era of Alan that you actively haven't liked? Or do you think it's all hit every time?
I think it's all hit. I mean, but I also sort of view myself as someone who enjoys the evolution of the character, you know, and I've enjoyed seeing it grow. So I think that Alan now is more sophisticated and therefore interesting and amusing. But I wouldn't look at earlier Alan and be like, because it's still great. You know, I wouldn't say it's worse. I don't think it's as good, but I still think it's excellent, if that makes sense. I love it all.
For you, what medium do you think suits best? Do you think it has been
interesting?
Do you think it's been that, like, the documentaries as opposed to the chat shows, as opposed to the sitcoms? Like, what for you? What is the best Partridge medium?
Well, I guess we're coming back to the nostalgia point, aren't we? And, you know, I loved the document. I love the spoofing of a documentary format. I love seeing how a voiceover can totally change something in Scissor Dial. And I love seeing that Alan's hand in the production of it all implicitly. But yeah, I mean, I think there are wonderful benefits to all of them. The show format is great because that's a really good way of, you know, exposing the gap between what he wants to be and what he actually is. So I thought that was a real benefit of this time. But I think that the joy of Partridge is you're kind of like, oh, okay, well, how's he going to fit into this format? And then he finds ways to be so funny in it. And I kind of like them all for different reasons. And as new media formats get created, I look forward to seeing hopefully how he slots into those, you know.
Well, actually, yeah. Is there something that you think he should do next? Or is there something, just flowing naturally on from what you've just said, what is the next thing for Alan to do? Or what would you like to see him do? Where do you think he would work?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Because if he carries on with presenting, I mean, I'd actually quite like to see Partridge in more of a political setting. I know that Mid-Morning Matters is kind of this, but that's sort of deliberately frivolous, isn't it? Whereas, you know, when he's doing the radio stuff. But I think maybe something on LBC would be quite funny, because that type of presenter does have a role on that. I don't know. I sort of feel as though he covers this a fair amount in this time. But it's when he does stuff on people's opinions or popularly held ideas or beliefs that I think is really, that I find really amusing. And that seems like quite a good format for that. But what other establishment media is there? Because he's not going to go and do Twitch, is he? Or TikTok?
Well, you could see him try and do that and fail, but I guess it's kind of, you've got limited laughs in that, haven't you? I think you do one piece of that and the joke is done. So, we've definitely had a few fans get in touch off the back of this time series 2 finishing and kind of predicting that he would go some kind of Nigel Farage, LBC, GB News type route. So it'd be interesting. There's an opening to go that way, but again, I don't know if that's fully the correct
reading of
I don't think it is. I think you're in danger of kind of looping back to sort of older Alan tropes.
Yeah.
Whereas they've been very clever and very careful to develop the character to come sort of away from that sort of right-leaning, where he's a little bit nastier, a little bit, arguably a bit more racist, sexist, homophobic. And they've kind of moved away from that. And I think they've been very clever to do that. And they've done it in a way that feels natural. And if he was to go down a sort of shock jock kind of route, like a Farage or a Piers Morgan or someone like that, it kind of is in danger of looping back around to the beginning. And I don't know if that's kind of a where they want to go.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, obviously we don't know. They'll do whatever feels right and for the moment. But yeah, it that doesn't quite sit right with
me. He says, doesn't he? He's like, Alan is, I think he did an interview with Joe, joe.co.uk, where he was saying that Alan is like the worst bit of the British establishment. He's all of the pomposity, but none of the intellect. And I suppose we need to find, which I think is such a brilliant, succinct explanation. And I think we need to find a format that is inherently pompous, which we get so excellently, of course, with his interaction with Princess Anne and his fawning over the royals, which I thought was excellent. I thought that was so deft about this absurd sort of, you know, bending over ourselves to bow to the royal family. Yeah, maybe there's something there, but it's difficult, isn't it? I also think that, I mean, the cool thing about Scissor Dial was that it was like, it was a response to, you know, division in Britain, right? A perceived divided Britain. So I think partially it might depend on how we're feeling about stuff in general, you know, in a year's time or whatever. Because, like, you know, if you're doing comedy now, like, you know, we talked about this earlier, but like me doing comedy in the middle of the pandemic versus me doing comedy now, they're two incredibly different things. And I'd argue that we maybe feel a bit more, I don't know. I think the pandemic probably did bring us together in some ways. I think we probably did feel a bit more united. So you certainly couldn't have done that, the idea of, you know, closing the chasm at that point. But yeah, I don't know. I think it will depend on what happens topically. But you're right. I don't think the political route's quite that. But it may be something with the royal family.
So I don't know if you've seen the tour announcement video for the Stratagem shows that he's going to do next year. So of course, in that setup, he does talk about the United Kingdom being a divided nation. So there's definitely, he's definitely leaning into that with whatever that tour is going to transpire to be. But whether that, I just feel like inherently that's going to be more about trying to bring right and left together. So again, that's him trying to do what he thinks is the right thing, as opposed to what some people are predicting, him taking a tilt to becoming a fully right-wing leaning character. That's the bit that doesn't feel quite right. So I think there's definitely going to be a continuation of that theme, but I think it's going to be Alan trying to kind of straddle both sides of the divide, as it were, and
getting that wrong. And that's to his credit as well, because I think, and I certainly can be accused of falling foul of this, I think the satire of the right can become, or mockery of the right, let's keep using satire while I've slammed the meaning earlier, mockery of the right can become a bit samey and boring from a comedic perspective. And that's not to suggest that there's not plenty of the right aren't doing wrong. But I think one of the brilliant things about Partridge is that you know exactly what party he votes for. But it's not sort of like, let's bash the Tory, which don't get me wrong, is fun. And I've done it. It's worked very well for me. But I think sometimes that can become a bit tired. And the fact that they don't really dip their toe in that water is really good, I think, because it just allows for that more subtle, less sort of white noise approach to mocking stuff. But yeah, I don't know. That's really intrigued me where he's going to go next. But the tour is going to be great. Do you guys? I presume you guys have tickets.
Yes, we have lined Steve's pockets furthermore for that, yes.
Yeah, it's fucking expensive, isn't it?
Yeah. it is, but we have every faith that it will be brilliant.
Oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be really good. Yeah. I can't wait to see this.
So, Josh, we should probably start wrapping things up because you've been very, very generous with your time today.
Pleasure. So I love talking about Partridge.
Before we do that, well, I think it's always interesting to talk about kind of other favourites just quickly, because it really, over the last couple of years, it really does feel like a bit of a golden age of TV comedy, whether you look at things like Staff Letters Flats, People Just Do Nothing, particular favourites of some of ours also being things like Motherland, What We Do in the Shadows, This Country. That's just to name a few, like off the top of my head. It feels like there's never been a better time to be watching TV comedy. For you personally, are there any other big favourites outside of Alan, like kind of anything recent or kind of classic comedy that's like a big linchpins for you?
Well, I mean, I think, sorry, I know I've referenced it before, but this is just causing shockwaves at the moment in comedy. The Bo Burnham special Inside that I saw on Netflix, it really, and this sounds over exaggerated, but I think it's probably the best thing I've ever seen. I'm sorry to blasphemously say that on this podcast of all places, but one of the most amazing things that I absolutely love, and I don't think it was very well critically received, and I don't unfairly in my opinion, was Sacha Baron Cohen's was it Who Is America or This Is America? I can't remember, but it was.
Oh yeah.
Did you guys watch that?
I never watched that actually, because I think the reviews were quite mixed, so I just never got around to it.
The reviews I thought that was so unfair, because one of my favourite characters in it is a character called Dr. Kane Niron Dilloncello or something, and he's a parody of the sort of, you know, apologist liberal. Person who's sort of trying to understand what went wrong when the election was stolen from President Hillary Clinton, he says, and he spends the time like cycling across America to heal the divide. And there's something, I just thought there was something so wonderfully deft about that parody of the sort of white person, you know, the privileged white person going, oh my God, how has this happened? I just can't believe this has happened. And just constantly sort of in that endless, you know, there's something very sort of white-centric about it. And I just thought that was so clever. And it's rare to see a really good parody of someone on the left or someone who's a liberal. And I think if you can do it well, there's big points to score. Because that actually requires so much more subtlety than parodying someone on the right. But yeah, I think Sacha Baron Cohen's a genius. I wasn't a massive fan of Borat 2, if I'm honest, because I think he relies on his characters not being known. And I think Borat 2, I mean, he did wonderful stuff with like Borat's daughter, but I almost felt like the film should have just been about Borat's daughter with him playing characters around it, you know. But I think he's amazing. I love watching old Johnny Vegas stand up. I've been rediscovering that recently. Have you guys?
Right.
I thought it was amazing. Just a guy having a breakdown on stage.
I've never really seen his stand up. Like my entry point to Johnny Vegas was just him being on endless panel shows, yeah, and being kind of like this drunken, playing this drunken character, whether you're not quite sure whether it's real or not.
Yes.
And he was the butt of the joke. He was the drunk. He was the jester. He was the, you know, the town drunk or whatever. And that was kind of the punchline. But not really seen much of his stand up.
It's basically that. It's a really heightened version of that, where you're just like, you're like, oh my God, he hates everyone. And he comes on. And also, I'm just so, I don't drink before I gig, because I, you know, you have to have an unbelievably, like, you have to be unbelievably quick on your feet. And I think it takes a real special talent for someone to be able to be drunk and perform and be funny. And I'm so impressed at how he could smash, by all accounts, probably about 11, 12 pints and then go on. And I mean that's just, but that's not even like, that's not fun drinking. That's just like, you know, self-annihilation. Yeah. But
that's very, very method.
Well, that's what I liked about it, because it was so, he pushed it right to the edge. And you're like, wow, this guy really is going to have a breakdown. And that, for me, just made it so much better. I just thought it was so funny. Another thing absolutely loved, and that way they've gone on to do great things, the writers of this, but Star Stories, which was, of course, written by the people who went on to write The Windsors, which I also absolutely loved. I just thought it was brilliant. It was just that sort of really unapologetic, broad brush caricatures of people and retelling stories unreliably that I just thought was so funny. And it's something we really need. You know, we need I'd love to see a pantomime of 2020. I think it's perfect for that type of thing, you know, because it's so grotesque and vulgar. That you could get, and the characters are so secure. I thought that was brilliant, particularly to take that one.
That's Kevin Bishop, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Was it Channel 4?
It was Channel 4, yeah. And he's so good. And also, and this was the stage I got to with impressions. When you watch that, you realize it's so much funnier to do a bad impression of someone, you know, like, than it is to do an accurate one, you know.
But shall we talk about the genius that is Bo Burnham?
Please, I would love to. I'd absolutely love to. I haven't shut up about it.
Yeah, it seems every day I'm opening Instagram stories or Twitter and I'm getting different people saying, oh my God, you have to watch this. Again, in terms of, you know, in a similar way to Partridge, you watch something once and you kind of consume it, and then you watch it a second time and you're purposefully looking out for other gags or other little things just in the background or whatever. And I just think he's so clever at that.
You know, we were talking about Cheeky Monkey, and how you've got Cheeky Monkey as a mouthpiece.
From Bo Burnham to Cheeky Monkey.
Yeah, yeah. So, but you know, like, you got Cheeky Monkey as a mouthpiece who's, and you expect him just to say a load of nonsense, but he's saying really credible things about women seeking refuge. When Bo Burnham has that white sock, which of course is taken from his love of Hans Taywin. Yeah. But the white sock, you know, is spouting all this Marxist philosophy, which is just so hilarious. And there's just so many layers, and it's so clever. And my entry point to him was, I watched Make Happy in 2016, and it blew my mind. It just absolutely blew my mind. Sorry, in 2018 I watched that, and from that point I was like, oh, I just really want to do stand-up. I really want to do something like this guy's doing, and it won't be as good, but I just want to do something. And it just was so amazing, and I just learned all the songs. And I used to love it. I thought he was so clever, and so his gags were so intelligent, and he was just so different and interesting as a voice. But I think, you know, for fans of his previous stuff, Inside is a whole new level. It's just above and beyond. The his targets are so deft. The stuff that he's taking the piss out of is so deft. But the explanation of his own mental state is amazing, and it's so musically contained. Like, all of the music feeds back into itself, and I just thought it was so brilliant. But I still don't even know what it was about. I mean, what do you think it was about for you? Like, what would you
say?
Here's the thing.
It's quite interesting. You've literally just spoken about Johnny Vegas and the fact that, like, you're looking at someone having a breakdown on stage. And is it real? Where is the line between reality and the person you've created to put into this format? That's kind of how I feel about that. Like, where is the line? Like, where does it stop being a person and start being a performance? And are those two the things the same thing? is this person genuinely having a breakdown because of the situation that he finds himself in, i.e. lockdown, coronavirus, not being able to go outside? Or is it just, you know, he's created a character and his character is that he's this version of himself having a breakdown? It's impossible to know because he's not going to do any press and he's not going to talk about it. He's not going to be the magician who reveals how he does his trick. He's not going to talk about it. So it's just up to the audience to work out whether this person is having a breakdown and how truthful that version is that he's projecting of himself is compared to reality. And I think that's where a lot of great comedy lies, is how much of this is an act and you don't know because they never explain it, and that's wonderful.
And I think the other thing I thought was great about it is it's a real mixture of, like, it's hilarious but it's also harrowing, and I really like the way there's actually quite a kind of narrative that draws you through. So it's almost like there's a first half which is a bit more joke based and a bit more poking fun at Instagram and this like political state of things in America.
Twitch.
And then you've got this second half, which is then a much more kind of personal exploration and becomes a lot darker and is still funny, but is also quite kind of troubling to watch in places as well. I think it's incredible.
The third time I watched it, you know, the bit where he's analysing himself. And then he's analysing himself, doing the song about being an unpaid intern.
That's the Twitch bit, right? The YouTube, reaction or something like that.
The YouTube reaction. Yeah, and he's like, I'm reacting to my reaction, and this is a bit pretentious, but yeah. And I watched that, and I was like, oh man, this just sounds quite nerdy, but it feels very much like Freud's distinction between the ego, the superego, and the id, in terms of self-analysis. My girlfriend's a psychologist, and I was like, I swear that's what he's doing. I swear. And actually, if you look through the special, there are lots of references to threes. A lot of the, like, cinematography, there's threes. The bit where he's doing the song about dissociation, there's three of him, like, laid over each other. And I sort of thought, is it that? Is that part of what he's trying to explore? And I don't know what the answer is, but I just thought that was particularly interesting. But he also looks very like Christ. Right, and there's the three images of himself is very like Christian mythology as well.
Like, I can't remember and I can't remember which song it is, but one of them ends with him sort of projected onto a cross, right?
Yes.
So
the problematic one.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yes, that's it. Yeah, that's it. But yeah, I mean, if for listeners who aren't familiar with Bo's work, we'll put some trailers in the show notes. But I urge you to go and watch. I think he's got What and Make Happy on Netflix, which are, you know, I think I discovered him through a video on YouTube and then was like, oh, this guy's got specials on Netflix, I'll check them out.
But I'd also say it's like, I think Inside is so good, and it, like, I've seen people calling it a masterpiece, and I'm not disagreeing, because I think it's kind of he's set a new benchmark with what his type of comedy does. But I'd almost recommend to people, don't start with that, because I think you need to see what a normal Bo Burnham show is like to appreciate how Inside works. Because, like you say, it's not stand-up as you would traditionally think. It's borderline musical theatre, but it's not musical theatre at the same time. There are so many things going on in it. I think it's absolutely brilliant.
You're so invested in him. I think that's what it is. He does a really good amount of self-awareness at the top, like talking about how unbelievably needless comedy is and how stupid and how he's white and doesn't need to be talking about something, which means that you really buy into him. So I think that helps. But yeah, he's just excellent. The music is so good as well. It's so well worked. It's just better than I haven't seen a special that good ever. It's depressing. It actually made me feel a bit depressed because I was so stifled by how excellent it was. I was just like, what is the point?
So with that in mind, what's next for you, Josh?
Well,
what are the projects you've got coming up that you can tell us about?
I'm going on tour, but it's probably just going to be shit compared to Bo Burnham. don't worry about coming to that. I'm going on tour through the autumn. I'm going to put that on sale soon. I'm also working on a book, which has been fun. Which, again, hasn't been announced yet. But I'm feeling in a generous announcement mood. And I want to sort of speak these projects into existence. And if I keep hiding them, It's just me performing to myself like Bo Burnham is doing. So those two things are happening.
Okay, so that's a tour in the autumn, and is the book this year?
I hope so. Yeah, I'm working my nuts off. It's Rafe's memoir of 2020.
Amazing.
Great.
So yeah, it's been a lot of research, a lot of work, but I'm really hoping that will be out by Christmas. But yeah, thanks for having me, Travis.
Yeah, thank you so much,
it's
Josh.
Yeah,
it's been amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about, you know, our favourite subject. I mean, it bloody well should be. We've done 119 episodes. So,
crikey.
But yeah, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
I am hopping mad, and I want something in the middle. Aha!
Yep, absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little pierce my foot on the spike.
With a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net.
Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.